So welcome to another Freebie Friday edition of Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. I am delighted to have you on board today. And I've done thousands of shows in the years that I've been on radio, terrestrial radio, XM Sirius satellite radio, overnight radio, and these podcasts that have become so prevalent in the world. It's a vast sea of information. But podcasting has become the latest and greatest iteration of the shows that I do. It's all about connecting. It's all about inform, entertain, and inspire. So finding those stories that are below the headlines, because I think the lifelines are far more important than the headlines most of the time. And rarely do we look past the headlines and find those lifelines. So whether I was on WGN talking about what was going on in the news, or on Oprah Radio with Dr. Oz or Gene Chatsky or Bob Green talking about what's going on in, you know, in health or money or fitness, or really when I started way back in the day when we were battling through recessions, it's always about looking underneath the obvious, which is usually buried in the absurd. This particular podcast today is, in my opinion, observation, and definitely my experience, different than anything I think I've ever done in regards to the content. I had to really dig on that because I've never had the opportunity that I had about a year and a half ago to meet with someone who was really a living part of history, in my opinion. I came across a woman who wanted to write a story about her life. Through some really unusual circumstances, my friend Dr. Kathleen Hall put me in touch with a woman named Trudy Groning. And Trudy had been working at a book, and being a published author myself twice and a fairly prolific writer, not so much in my prose, but in the content, the amount of content I've been put out over the years, blogs and what have you. I've worked with a lot of people as a ghostwriter slash coach, and there's a whole different energy that goes into all that. So anyway, Trudy Groning had a book idea, and you know, quite frankly, most people have a book in them somewhere. It's just a matter of pulling it out and the energy and the resources to do that have to all be in order. The universe kind of has to line all the dominoes up for that to happen. And I'd already done it three times before, so I'm kind of used to the drill. There's a process that really needs to be put in place. It takes some serious dedication and discipline. Whether you're writing a parable that's 75 to 100 pages long or you're going to knock out 400-page novel, it's a lot of work. And it is not for the faint of heart. So I got a call one day from Trudy Groning, who lives in Pennsylvania, and we had a nice talk. And she started telling me about this book that she'd been working on since 1967. I was 8 years old, going on nine, when Trudy started this book. You can imagine how I felt about that part of it. And the second part was, I said to Trudy, so just, email me what you have so far in 50 years. And I'm thinking there's going to be, 1,000 pieces of material coming my way. And she said, oh, first of all, I don't do much in the way of email. I will print these out and snail mail them to you. And secondly, I only have 44 pages done. There's actually 64 pages, but 20 were redundant, repetitive. So there's really only 44 pages. So I'm thinking to myself, after 50 years, if you only have 44 pages, I don't know that I can help this project along. She sent them to me. I still have most of the originals here. She didn't want them back. I did send her a few things back, but the original stuff that she sent came in an envelope in the mail, which was very Norman Rockwell-ish, but also very antiquated system to be able to write a book. So I went through the 44 pages, and really what it started out to be, and I was surprised, that it was an account of her life growing up in Nazi Germany during the Holocaust, but not as a Jew who experienced that as a young girl, but as a German citizen. And I had never met anybody who had that experience. I have friends, and I've talked with elder people who have survived the Holocaust and the horrors of all that, but I'd never met anybody who grew up in Nazi Germany under Hitler rule that was a German and was still alive and wanted to tell a story. So right away there was moment. The second part of it is, because of the difficulty of the situation at the time as a young girl, This was written as fiction. And so Trudy Groning had created a character named Jane Raber, and Jane had become her voice because in so many ways, I think Trudy lost hers through the things that she had seen and witnessed back then. So I have two pieces sitting here. I have some serious history, and then I have a fictional account of that serious history as told by Trudy Groning, who lived it. I think I sat with this for about 3 weeks before I decided that I would take this on. Once you start a project like this, there is no stopping. And the fact of the matter is that I had this deadline in my head because Trudy Groning was now 89 years young. I thought, listen, calling it what it is, we're all on borrowed time. So I have an 89-year-old would-be author who has an amazing story to tell. I have 44 pages to work with, and what do I do with it? I started reading it. I went back and forth and back and forth, and 3 weeks later, after talking with a few people and seeing, look, I wanted to do it justice, and I didn't know that I could. So I had not lived those things. Trudy did. And how was I going to overcome, you know, not having that direct experience? How was I going to overcome this age gap between us? How was I going to certainly overcome the technical aspects of this? If she doesn't email, this is going to be very, very challenging, very, very difficult. And that was really the key in the whole deal. So I went out to Pennsylvania, and I took out my trusty, dusty Dell laptop and connected that to my recording equipment that I do these podcasts on. And I sat down for 3.5 hours on the second day that I was there and met Trudy in person and her husband, John. And we talked for 3.5 hours. I asked questions. She answered. We went through all this. It was an incredible experience for me and for her. And so this audio sat as a backup to those 44 pages that the book A Matter of Grace was built on. Add to that, since 1967, Trudy has battled MS. So she grew up in Nazi Germany under Hitler rule. She became a ward bride in 1948. She comes to the United States. Her first husband dies of Legionnaire's disease. She is then diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and you think you're having a bad day? So months went by, a lot of hard work on both our parts and a lot of editing and a lot, I mean, the process, mind-boggling. It is without question, even writing my own books, the most challenging, difficult, and rewarding thing that I've ever watched and been witness to was the creation of the book, A Matter of Grace. At some point in the last month or two while I was doing these podcasts, I thought to myself, maybe I should spend a little time with that audio. And even though people are buying the book all over the world, and it's thrilling for Trudy to get feedback on this book, maybe this is a podcast. And so I've spent a fair amount of time chopping up 3.5 hours of audio that was very, very private and with her permission, and I've created this particular episode. So what you're going to hear today is really something else. I'm going to urge you as well to please go out and buy her book. It's not very expensive. You can get it on Amazon or Lulu, wherever books are sold, and I'll let you know how to do that at the end of the episode. And of course, when you clicked on to play this, you can see a link where you can order Trudy's book. And I know a lot of people that want to be authors, and they don't have half the guts and the energy and the stamina that Trudy Groning has to help put this thing together. We worked on this very close and had a lot of phone calls, and she kept mailing things in snail mail, and it was just an amazing experience. So without further delay, this is segment one. Here's Trudy Groning. 3, 2, 1, and we are recording. We're at level 100%, so we're good. Just say your name.
This is Trudy Groning, and I live in Willow Valley in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
And it's a beautiful place.
Oh, I do. I think so. We're so blessed. We feel the Lord's led us here.
But you're not from here originally.
No, I'm not.
You're from Munich, Germany.
That's right. I was born in München in Deutschland.
When you were growing up in Munich and you were becoming more and more aware of your family and your surroundings and your culture. What would it like to be 8, 9, 10 years old in Germany at that time?
Okay. I was born in 28, and the war started in 39, September 1st. And that would make me, what, 10? Yeah, mm-hmm. 10, because my birthday is not until December. So I was 10 years old, and I lived in a neighborhood. There were a lot of Jewish families lived. In fact, the house the building that I lived in, five-story building, were owned by Jews, and only the owners tolerated only Jewish people that lived there.
Mm-hmm.
And my father and mother were looking for a place, and this was just ideal. And she relented. Mrs. Wallhaus relented and said, "Oh yeah, I'll give you that apartment." And so she, my mother and dad moved in. And
why do you think she relented and gave the apartment?
Well, because of my father, who was a violin maker and had a name from going back to Hans Raab was my father's name, and Hans Raab was my grandfather's name, and he is the one that was a purveyor to the court of King Ludwig. And so she knew all this history. And she said, "Yeah, well, you may have this apartment."
Because of his name, his reputation.
Of his reputation, yeah. Right. And maybe it had a twofold meaning, because the building was occupied by many Orthodox Jewish people, and my mother was quite willing to be the person who would come on a Friday night and light their fires in mm-hmm. the winter, or in any of the chores mm-hmm. that Jewish people couldn't do in the certain times. And so she was the Sabbath woman for them. And so naturally, when we children, we made friends with the children in the house, and so I had a very important little friend. Her name was Avi. And now the year we're talking about is the year I'm talking about is 38.
Mm-hmm.
So that Jews had not been started to be persecuted. Yep. Oh, there were rumbles. There were rumbles many all through all. It was an individual thing. German households started, it was the custom of German households, included Jewish households, to go shopping for the day's meals in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And as you meet people on the street and in the shops, you would take time to catch up with the customer, with the gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And
people really took time with each other.
They did.
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe you've heard of the word Gemütlichkeit. Gemütlichkeit is not just a word. It is a being. Bavaria was pervaded with Gemütlichkeit. It was, how would I say it? It was just there.
And what does the word mean?
Gemütlichkeit. You have a beer in one hand, a radish or pretzel in the other,
mm-hmm.
and you eat and talk.
I don't know that I can eat a radish and drink beer, but I'll do the pretzel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The pretzel. Oh, good pretzels. Yeah.
Hard pretzel?
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, anyway, you have to go to Munich to get a good pretzel.
And so people would take the time and do this and connect with each other.
Well, no. Yes and no. We're at the point where I'm going shopping in the morning. You don't have a pretzel and a beer when you go shopping.
Oh, that's not in the morning. Okay.
No, not then.
But they'd shop for the day each day.
Each
one day at a time.
That's right. Mm. That's right. Before refrigerators or anything like that. And so you always had your fresh fruit. Your vegetables, maybe they hold over. But the rumbles, I'm talking about, people were saying, what's going to happen with the Jews? I don't know. But, you know, Hitler has a right way to do things. He'll send them all back to Palestina. And that's where they belong anyway. This is their regular talk.
And this is before the wars actually.
Yes.
And so even before the war, there was talk that somehow these people who were friends of yours to some degree were the problem.
Had a problem.
Well, that they need to be, that they were part of the problem. They need to go away.
Yes.
Some people felt that way.
Yes.
Mm. Why do you think they felt that way?
Well,
Hitler was somehow pointing out that the Jews were part of the problem.
In his speeches, he was such a bushy-cose person. He just pounded. He pounded on a desk and he jumped up and down. And these Jews are a rabble, and they're just. They don't belong into an Aryan culture and need to be removed. Oh, I can hear that man saying stuff like that today.
So you'd hear that on the radio?
Yes.
At home?
Yes, yes. And then one day, the Gestapo came. Oh, the Gestapo was always around. I better back up a little bit. You wouldn't talk about your feelings because they had... We called them Spitzels.
What's that?
A Spitzel is just the Bavarian expression for a nosy person who's got his nose into everything.
Mm.
My mother used to say, don't talk, not even in among your family, because walls have ears.
Wow.
They used to take a cup, an empty cup, and hold it against your ear and against the wall to see if they could hear something. It was a persecution.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. And and then the Gestapo, we heard them trampling up the stairs. We lived on the bottom, on the street level. And they came up and trampled up there and hauled off every radio from every Jew. They could have no radio. And
did they leave your family alone?
Oh, they left us alone. We
no
were
problem.
Not Jewish.
Yeah,
no
problem.
I had no problem. No problem at all. But I had a friend upstairs.
Yeah.
And I was torn. I was, well, not yet.
Yeah.
Mm. At this point, I was still thinking, nobody's going to do anything. So we still, her mother said to us, now, Trudy, Avi, you children cannot go be seen together anymore on the street.
Mm.
If you want to play at something, and you come to the courtyard out back. It has high walls, so high, And it's a very private matter, and you can play out there and take your toys. So at least we could spend some time together. Yeah.
Kind of keep everything away. Just be kids.
Mm-hmm. Just be kids yourself, but be away from everybody's eyes.
Yeah.
And so then Avi got two little green frogs from her parents for her birthday. And I had a little doll. It was a boy doll with all the Bavarian costume outfits on. And we played with that and with her two frogs. And somehow that one day that we played down in the courtyard, something bothered me. She wasn't the same. She didn't talk much. And I don't know, as a child, you pick up things. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly she said, well, we were chasing the frogs, that's what it was. They were hopping around there. And we were chasing them, and the other one came, tried to catch up with Mux and Moritz was their names.
You remember their names?
Yes, yes. Moritz got there. I don't know how we kept them apart. Moritz jumped, and Max followed, and we were just funny. Once in a while, I just put my Gottlieb. Was the name of my little doll, boy doll.
Mm, Gottlieb.
Yes, that means a loving God. It was a German name.
Sure.
It really was.
Sure.
Gottlieb. And I put him aside. We were playing with the frogs. And then she suddenly stopped. She says, you know, I'm going away. And I said, where are you going? I don't know, but I'll be gone for a long time. I said, well, how long? When will you be back? I don't know. And then she took her little frogs and put them in the terrarium and took her little terrarium and just walked away. And it puzzled me, but I didn't say anything. Kids, they just...
Sure.
And then, that night, I believe it was either that night or maybe the next night, we heard at dinner time, we heard the noise out in front of the door. It's not that the house door wasn't really yet the house. The street where you open the street door, there was a corridor and a few steps up, and that's where we heard all that noise. And we all piled to the front door. Wouldn't dare open it, just a little bit so we can see what's going on. We saw it was the Gestapo, and they all marched up and got the people out of their apartments and took them down to a waiting vehicle. Must have been a truck. In front of the house. And Evie, I saw her.
Mm.
It was the next day. It was the next day because the evening before, she gave me her two little frogs, Mux and Moritz. There was just a little tiny knock on the door, and Mom opened up my mama, and she said, Frau Hirsch, kommen Sie rein, kommen Sie rein. Oh, Frau Raab, es besser nicht. Evie has something she wants to give to Trudy. And that's all. So I came running, and she gave me her two frogs, Max and Moritz. And I said, Evie, I'm gonna take good care of them until you come back. And then I ran in the back and got my Gottlieb. And I said, you take this and keep it, and I'll take good care of Max and Moritz. And we hugged, and off they went right away. They ran up the steps. And then the next the next morning, midday or sometime there, they went up, the black boots pounded up the stairs and hauled everybody away. And I saw Evie. Where are you going? She said the day before. I don't know. When will you be back? I don't know. And I thought, maybe that's where she's going now, but where could it be? It must be to Palestine. Like Frau Gessen said, that's where they're going, to Palestine, yes. Palestine, I knew was far, far away, but didn't really pull all this together in my mind. And then they went. Then they went off, and Mama closed the door fast, hard, quick. And then she said, "Children, let's go in the living room, and I need to talk to you." And Papa was there. Both of them, Papa said, "This is not to be discussed with anybody, what you saw tonight. Not among each other, nor with your comrades in school, nor with your friends. You saw nothing. This is very important." And Mama said, that's right, because walls have ears. Oh, that word again, walls have ears. So I learned to be quiet, not talk, just listen. Keep it to myself. And then for me it was school time. Well, the next day, I guess it was. School went on as usual, but that night, from the next night, all this, it is now called Kristallnacht. For us it was Kristallnacht. Everything was broken that belonged to the Jews. All their shops, all their synagogues. And just everything. Kristallnacht. And I went to school. Nobody. It was to be handled as though nothing was wrong. Nothing happened. And so we did. And I sat down at my usual place in my classroom. And Fräulein, at that time, teachers, women teachers at least, were had to be single. They could not be married. They had to be a Fräulein. So it was Fräulein at that time was Gerabeck. Fräulein Gerabeck didn't say a thing when the door opened about the Kristallnacht. Nothing, she mentioned nothing. We just went on, right on with the lesson. And then suddenly the door to the classroom opened and a man walked in with his ladder, set up his ladder, climbed up and took down the crucifix.
Mm.
That belonged there, over top of that door frame. So many years there. He just took it down and put a Hitler picture up there. Folded up his ladder and went away. Every eye went to Fräulein Gerabeck. And then she said, and then she didn't mention anything. She just kept right on talking about the lesson that we had that day, whatever it was.
So what you heard in that first segment was the background, what it was like growing up, and some of her more interesting aspects of her life in Munich growing up under Hitler rule. This second segment coming up talks quite a bit about her little friend Avi. And remember, this is all in the book in fiction form because it was just very difficult for her to recall and remember a lot of this because of the pain involved. I can't even imagine. You know, the thing that kept coming back to me time and time again as I worked on the book with Trudy and wrote passages, long chapters of stuff that got edited back and forth, was it's all about perspective. I've said this on every show that I've ever been on. It is all about history is our teacher. If we do not learn from it, and I didn't think this up, we are doomed to repeat it. And humans seem to like to repeat stuff over and over again, expecting it to be different. And it isn't different because we don't change. So in this segment, you're going to hear much about Avi and how difficult that was for her. Truly courageous, courageous stuff on Trudy's part.
We knew there was somehow we sensed, not only sensed it, but we were really gripped by it. I think that there's danger. And then I went walking home past to where Avi went to school in the synagogue, and that was all destroyed. And then I was thinking about all the other people I knew. Frau Steinberg had a little candy shop and cigars and so forth, little shop. And that was all destroyed. And then, and then there was a Mari. I always thought she had the most beautiful earrings. She had dangling earrings with little not grapes, but those red.
Like a raspberry?
Raspberry, thank yeah. you. Raspberries had dangling. Oh, they fascinated me. And besides that, she was always in such daring colors, in high heels.
Oh, boy.
And nobody talked to her. She was a gypsy. But I was fascinated by her. I wanted to touch those earrings. They looked like the real thing. And she wouldn't talk to me. And she said, it's dangerous for you to talk to me and dangerous for me also. And you just better go on. So she was gone, and she was gone, and a lot of other people I knew, and they were all gone, and there was the class. grass all over the place, on the streets. And then came the looters. That's what appalled me. Looters with their baskets just walked into the Jewish places and grabbed what they wanted and walked off. Oh, I knew there was something wrong somewhere. But walls have ears. You don't talk. You don't ask. Oh, man, there was something heavy sitting on my chest. I just didn't know what it was. It was a psychological affliction, I think. But what did I know about all that when I was small, young? But I knew there was something happening. In fact, a couple of days later, I took such good care of the Max and Moritz. A couple of days later, they were both dead in the morning when I got up. Just laying in there, just dead. And I screamed, "Mama, Mama, something happened to Ivy. Something happened to her. The frogs are dead." And some things are just not very nice, very comfortable to talk about. But I never heard from Avi again. But later I heard about concentration camps and how they were gassed and killed, shot, whatever. I had an occasion in my later life to go to Israel, and I could not go into. I wanted to look for Avi, for Avi's name. And I stood before the Vat Vashem, and I could not go in. I didn't want to see her name on those lists. I just couldn't bear it. So I got there to the door, and I never looked. I just walked away, just like Avi did. Walked away with her frogs. Yeah. I walked away from that door of Vat Vashem. To this day, I don't know what happened to her, but we had another little family living on the floor above Avi. Kapon was the name. And they had a son. His name was Kurt. And Kurt was about 14. I was, 10 at the time. Mm-mm. And he proposed to me.
Oh.
He did. That was my first proposal of marriage. And his mother was there. And he said, "Mama, I'm going to marry Trudy one day." And she said, "Oh, Kurt, this can never be. This can never be." And he just turned and he was so sad. I remember his face. Who's to understand what all that meant? And then I couldn't go in that Vat Vashem and look for his name either.
One of the most difficult parts of working on A Matter of Grace with Trudy Groning was about her father, who was a Renaissance man in every sense of the word, a devoted family man, and it was the most difficult chapter of the book to write her memories of her dad. I'm not going to go into great detail in the setup or the intro of this part of the podcast. I'll let her do all that. But there's a picture of her dad in there that I could not and still cannot to this day get out of my mind. I kept thinking about how proud her father would be of her for telling the story, telling his story, telling the family story, telling the story of that time. So when you get the book, and you should, A Matter of Grace by Trudy Groning on Amazon.com, I suggest you go to Lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com, and you can get it right from there because the production costs are different when you buy at different platforms. And as an author myself, it's always great to have a few more bucks in your pocket. So go to Amazon, preferably Lulu, order A Matter of Grace by Trudy Groning, G-R-O-N-N-I-N-G, and you can read this chapter and see a picture of her dad, which I just think is an amazing, amazing thing. So we've covered about Avi and Kurt.
Yeah.
Kurt. Marriage proposal when you were 10 years old. Tell me about your pop.
My dad?
Yeah. And by the way, as soon as you said my dad, you...
Yeah?
So much pride in your papa, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was a lovely man. He was never the drill sergeant in our family. That was my mother.
With her gloves on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was a very refined person, but my father was the one that was refined, a gentleman.
Was his dad a violin maker as well?
Oh, yeah.
So he passed down. I have to just listen. You're getting to understand. I will stop you when I need to stop you from talking. I'm amazed at your body language right now. So before, when you were telling me your stories, you were like this. And as we stopped that, you sat up, and with your father and the rest, you're up, way up here. It's so interesting to me.
Oh yeah. Well, I was proud of my dad.
Yeah.
Yes. He died much too suddenly. Our family was not destitute, but we were going that way. And my father had... Nobody bought violins anymore.
Sure.
And that's the big thing. No instruments, all stringed instruments, not just violins. And he had an offer to be the opera conductor in Halle. On Saale, that's the river Saale, where Halle is, H-A-L-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
And what a blessing that was at the right time. Oh, and so he accepted, and accepted for the season.
Mm-hmm.
And
but he had to leave his family.
Yes. Halle was, 200, 300 miles.
Mm.
So he was, we said goodbye to him. Oh, he was so sad to say goodbye to my dad. But he said, I said, Papa, when will you be back? When will you be back? Oh, as soon as I can make it. As soon as I have a break, as soon as I my first break from my duties, I will be back. Okay. And it just never came. He died 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks. He was gone maybe 5 weeks or 3 weeks. I'm not sure about the time, mm-hmm. but it happened during the conducting of the opera Aida.
Mm.
Have you ever heard of
mm-hmm.
Aida?
Mm-hmm.
And he just fell dead while he was conducting. And that was the end of that.
How did you find out? How did your mom find out?
Oh, yeah, I wonder.
Yeah. Telegram, maybe, something?
Telegram, I think.
Do you remember hearing that he had passed? Do you remember that day when you found out?
I think I was in school at the time and didn't know it until I got home. And my mother was a very resolute decision maker. She said, now, yes, it comes back. Now, children, I did my crying. You may have your time about crying, but I have to sort out how I'm going to make a living for us. Da muss ich alles herbringen. Aber da zeichnet Kimmen Kinder. Es wäre schon wieder. Pass nur auf. Ja, ich mach das schon. I will do it.
And so by now it's 1967, and Trudy is diagnosed with MS, and this is a bit about her journey and how challenging and difficult that disease is and how all those pieces really moved her in a direction that she never thought she'd be able to handle. And in the book, the chapters on MS talks about, you know, the little wake-up calls that came her way and the things that, you know, she had to go back in her history and take a look at how did this happen and why to her. And after you've been through so much in life, how can you endure even any more that is sent your way? And she has. When I spent time with her in Pennsylvania, we'd go down to dinner. I was the youngest person except for the people that worked there at the table. And I'm surrounded by these people who were just titans of their time, and they still are in so many different ways. Very humbling for me. But we would go down to dinner or go down to breakfast, and John and I would go first, and Trudy would take her walker and find her own route and show up with a smile at the age of 89. And so when I have a little bit of an ache or pain somewhere, I think of her quite often, and that's a very good thing. Yesterday, you were it was just very moving to me. To hear you talk that, and I want to see if I can repeat that a little bit about how that was for you, finding out what were the circumstances that led that to that diagnosis.
Okay. Well, let me try to. Dr. Hartenauer was my doctor at the time, and I kept telling him I have funny feelings. Like,
how old were you?
My 30s. It started about 35.
Okay.
Yeah, and I said, there's something cruising up my spine. That's the nervous system, like, cruising up my spine, and it came to like a slap. Only I was the only one that could hear it. But yet it wasn't audible.
Mm-hmm.
It was just
this feeling.
Just a feeling, yeah. And he said, "Well, just have to." Wait and see. I didn't make any notes of that, but wait and see how it turns out. This could be something a passing thing. Yeah, all right. And it kept on doing that, but then I started tingling, tingling in my fingers and in my toes. And he said, "Well, I can't really diagnose you until I see you in an attack." And I thought, what kind of attack is he talking about? A heart attack or what? Attack meant something major. Okay, I thought I'll let it go. And then I couldn't ski anymore. I mean, even on my good days, I had good and bad days. Mm-hmm. Even on my good days, I was walking okay. I was, but the balance wasn't there anymore. It was a puzzling thing. The workup to that point, where I, in the morning, I couldn't get out of bed, and as I told you, I just crawled to the, like a soldier in a war, crawling to the bathroom to get sick. And I called the doctor. I said, I'm in an attack, the one you're waiting for. I don't know whether I said it that way, but that's what I meant.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I'll send the ambulance for you. I said, well, my friend is picking me up from... he's picking me up and take me to the hospital. I'll meet you in the hospital. And that's what he said, vestibulitis peripheral sclerosis. Peripheral has something to do with the ears.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember that word.
Yeah.
But I said, maybe it's peripheral sclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if there was such a diagnosis, such a word, but I was trying to tell him, you know, it's not what you said.
Yeah.
And just arguing with him. Yeah. No. No, it is multiple. And that's when it happened. I thought somebody just pulled the rug out from under my feet, and I was in suspended in something. When he said that to me, I thought, well, my life is over. What am I going to do with such a disease? My life is finished. And my mother is not here anymore. She went back to Germany, and I was alone. And then I meet you in the hospital. Okay. And then they started an ACTH drip.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what ACTH?
I don't know what it stands for, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's a derivative of cortisone.
Mm.
And I didn't know all that. Found out later. And they'd get that drip 9 hours. My goodness. And then the 9 hours weren't even over yet, about 7 or 8 hours. Then something started hurting me real bad. Oh, double up. They had to take the IVs out and rush me to the surgery section. And they called my surgeon. And he did the surgery, and said, "Well, you had a very serious appendicitis; it was about to burst."
Hmm.
Then he took it out, and then when I wanted to send for my records, they wouldn't let me see it, and that puzzled me no end. Oh yeah, This was after John and I were married. records that the Air Force had to send for my records when I was in the hospital. They needed all that. But in the Air Force, if you have to go from one doctor to the other doctor in the same building, they give you the records.
To carry them, sure.
To carry them. And so I took my records and I stopped in the bathroom and read them. And it said multiple sclerosis and appendicitis, and took out the appendix and found they were there was cancer. I'm trying to find the word that was. It was underlined in red. Adenocarcinoma. It's adenocarcinoma. I worked in the Blue Cross, and I know all those words. Carcinoma. That's cancer. I didn't know that.
And they didn't tell you.
And they didn't tell me. They didn't tell me about the MS until I backed my doctor into a corner. I'm not leaving here till you tell me what's wrong. So he told me about the... but then he couldn't tell me about the carcinoma because it wasn't his case. That was another doctor. But I found all this out from that visit, from that stop in the bathroom. And so, but to this day, I'm not even talking to doctors about what I had. When that, once you have cancer, they come up with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Never even happened.
Yeah.
So I thought, see, it comes in handy to don't talk.
I was just going to say, all this kind of keeps playing itself out. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And since that time, diagnosed, and you found all this information out, how did you go about going through it all these years? The struggle with it every day. I watch you take your steps. I watch you, obviously, this is years of this. How was it in the beginning? How did you handle it?
Well, my balance problem was really getting to me. And I thought, well, only one thing to do. I couldn't walk on sand anymore. I went to the beach most every weekend. Made myself walk on that sand. It wouldn't hurt me if I fell.
What the heck, you know? Right, right.
Yeah, so I got to strengthen my equilibrium. So that's how I did it until I finally gave up. I thought, no, no.
You didn't see any improvement?
No. No improvement and no... Oh. Well, it was just too hard to keep on going.
And you've already...
Silly if I did.
And you already have a family and children and all this? And or is that later?
My son was in Vietnam.
Yeah, Larry.
Larry. Yeah. He was... she were here now, but... When I was diagnosed, it was 1967. He went to Vietnam in 67. March. No, later. It was later in the summer when he went. But it was the year of 67. And he came back in 68 after Vietnam. Had a year over there. And then got married. As soon as he got back, I was trying to say to him, no, I don't think it's a smart thing for you to get married before you go over there.
Right.
She may not be there when you get back.
Yeah.
For you, you know.
And he was lucky to get back. A lot of boys didn't come back. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I would have been sorry that I said, no, don't marry.
Yeah, let me hold you right there for a second.
Yeah.
So you were, this was 1967. And just 32 years earlier, you were watching World War II.
Yeah.
And all that went along with that. Your brother went to the Navy.
Yeah.
How was, what did you, there has to be, I don't even know what the word's not concern, that's not even the right word, but you've already seen this once in your lifetime.
Yes.
How did you see this, but knowing your son was going there?
Yeah, second war in my life. And now my son's there. Yeah, that wasn't easy to take, but you know, I was proud of him.
He's in the Marines.
In fact. I don't know how I could say that. I didn't want him to be there because he's my son, but he is a patriot. He has to be there. That's the way he left with that in his mind. He's
sure.
Got to be there.
Sure.
And I said, he's right. So I was okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Judy, she came in handy really for me too.
Mm.
She kept in touch with him every day.
Oh boy.
Yes, in some fashion or other. And she would send him things and had his, he took a picture. Somebody took a picture of him. Oh, this was in the newspaper even, a picture. Oh, I could probably get it from Judy, where he put a flag. They were fighting for a Hill 55, it was called.
Hmm.
And the Marines took that hill. And Larry had a flag that Judy sent him to put on that on that hill. Wow. That belongs to Delaware. It's a Delaware flag.
New Delaware.
New.
There you go.
Yeah. So that made the papers.
So, but the struggle, you were able to rectify it and say, even though it's the second war in your lifetime, and you would rather he didn't go, you were able to see the reasons for it.
Yes. My goodness. And besides that, I sent a boy.
Yeah.
With a boy's shape.
Yeah.
In his body.
Yeah.
And then I saw that picture of him standing there on that hill. That's Larry.
The way that chapter ends in the book, and of course what you just heard was about her son going in Vietnam and you know, surviving that. And most interesting to me is that the man that she would marry, you're going to hear about John coming up here in just a second, he actually had contact. Now, they kind of knew each other. John was in the Air Force and Larry was in the Marine Corps, but they had made contact with each other during the war. And so to come to find out that, you know, once John came back from Vietnam, he and Trudy would eventually get married. And, you know, however that's worked out, he already knew Larry from Vietnam, and they end up, John and Trudy, getting married. So it's a great story, and he's a great guy. He's we had a little running joke going. John's 86, 87 now, I guess. And when I would go out there, he's about half my size, so he was little John and I was big John, but I've heard that before in my life. But you know, when I first met them out front of their retirement village, Trudy was sitting on a bench with a big hat on and sunglasses, and John was standing at rigid attention, like he did in the Air Force as an officer. And I was so struck by that. There she was sitting on the bench in the sun. And here was this guy who had military bearing about him. You know, and when you're in it and you're at that level, it never leaves you. And I've just really enjoyed my conversations with John over the past year and a half. And so here's a little bit more about how they met and their story. Who is Chris in the book?
That's John.
Yeah, and so John's your husband.
Mm-hmm.
How did you two meet, and how did that all come together for you?
Okay. I loved skiing. And I joined a ski club. And when they went over to Europe, I flew with them. And I had to stick to the, would you believe, Bonny Hills, because I could no longer manage to ski down. So, but anyway, I stuck with the club, and it was fun doing that. One day, I was notified the club's going to have a social, and so I went there. Best Bib and Tucker, and in an Al introduced me to a new person that just came to socialize with us.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't skiing, and then, well, then I found out who he was, and I was enamored by by John. He was a handsome
kid. I bet still is.
Well, yeah, but nothing like he was.
I bet.
When he had hair. anyway, that Saturday, I don't know when it was, we met. And what all the talk was, I don't remember the details, but we wound up with giving him my telephone number, and he said, "I'll call you as soon as I have another free day."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Okay." Never thinking much more about it, not about him.
Yeah.
But never thought that thinking of my MS is what kept me making plans of the heart with anyone, doesn't matter. I didn't feel good enough to have somebody take over my part of their life to give to an invalid.
Yeah.
Bing, snap, snap, snap. Bing, 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 the doctor said. You could be in a wheelchair. You remember reading that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
That bing, bing, bing kept me from being free on my thoughts for a future with a person, especially a person like John, an officer. What would he do with an invalid wife? And those thoughts is what kept me thinking, well, I haven't even seen the world yet. I need to see some things. So I booked myself on a flight to Morocco and got arrested and put in jail. And then I...
yeah.
Do you remember... Dinosaur?
Oh, sure.
Well, that's what I did. Oh, just like Dinosaur.
Yeah.
You know, we could have been jailed and forgot about.
That's right. You could still be there.
That's right. We had no diplomatic immunity with Spain at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that out after we got back home, and the PA, public relations officer at work. That's who told me. Do you know what a chance you took? No idea. No idea. train of thought was that. So I booked myself on a flight to Morocco, because. I mean, who's going to put any credence in the fact that I might marry again, or somebody might marry me? So that's why that episode with the Morocco trip. And then I came home, and I'm getting this telephone call that John is, he said he's gonna, he has a weekend off, and he wants to come to Delaware, and we're gonna be married. Just like that.
Just like that.
Just like that. And he said, I'll be there Friday, and we can apply right for a marriage license right that day, because that was a 24-hour wait or some such thing. And then Saturday, we can clear out your house. You can't. We can't take a thing with us. And then on Sunday, we get married.
And it's just the way it is.
Yeah, that's the way it is. And see, so we did that, and I was married.
That was it. Again, you're ready, and here you are. And so here you thought you maybe damaged goods for the rest of your life. Could be bing, 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 but the bing, bing, bing turned out to be John, John, John. How did he, have you ever asked him?
I have to tell you this before I forget it. You see, there's a twist to that.
He obviously didn't care or see that.
That's right. And there's the crux of the matter, I tell you. We spent the time in overseas, and he was commissioned to go to the next station, and that was Florida. Mm-hmm. We flew to Delaware because we needed a car, and he wanted to buy it. So we purchased a car in Delaware. You don't pay taxes in Delaware, you know.
Well, I didn't know that.
No.
Yeah.
Would you believe? Buy a car without taxes.
I go buy a car.
That's why all the politicians
back.
Come from D.C. to buy their cars in Delaware. And so he bought a car, and for the first time, I'm going to see his parents. I'm going to meet his parents.
Wow.
I had never met them.
Wow.
And then it was, far ways away, because Washington, D.C. I mean, Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
Long trip.
Yes.
Yeah, so we finally got to Marysville in Washington. And everybody was saying, "Oh, we're gonna have a welcome home party for John. Oh, this is a big thing." They rented a hall, and my golly, it was very nice. And then I saw this lady with crutches, and I said, "John, who is that?" "Well, that's my sister." So I went right to her. I said, "Oh, so happy to meet you," and the usual things you say.
Yeah, sure.
And I said, "I do have to ask you, though, if you don't mind, did you break a leg?" "No," she said, "I thought you knew. I have MS. I said, and I couldn't talk for a second. I said, "Does John know?" "Oh, yes." "When did you tell him?" "Oh," she says, "when he came home from Vietnam." When he came home from Vietnam. And right after that visit with his parents, he came to Delaware to see me.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew about MS with his sister, and I'm hitting him with the same thing.
And it didn't matter. Didn't even hesitate.
I don't know that. He didn't talk.
Didn't talk about it.
Not a word.
Obviously, his actions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Show you that it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
But I couldn't accept me being in such a situation with a man like that. That was the hard part.
And so to wrap this up, Trudy gets the last part of this. This is her close. I want to remind you that while this is great to listen to in audio form, I promised Trudy that I would help spread the word. I think that her story is incredible. I think that she's amazing. At the age of 90, she's an author. I feel so humble and blessed to have been the one that somehow the universe picked out to help her finish this book after 50 years. I was a kid when she started putting pencil to paper about this story, and now I'm pushing 60 and she's 90. I've had a lot of achievements in my life. I've had awards and things, and it's all well and good, and there's a short list of things that I can sit back at the end of the day and go, wow, I don't even know how to categorize that. I don't know what the odds are that we'd be in each other's orbit. You know, I took German in high school, so the whole year or so we worked on this book together, even though it's mostly over the phone, she kind of got me back into the German stuff. So there have been a couple places where German is in the book. There's a translation, so you don't have to do it yourself. And I was working on my own German stuff again from back at Schurz High School. And Guten Morgen and Guten Abend and oh my gosh. And it was just a reconnection to my own heritage because I have that, both German and Swedish. So there's a lot of gifts in here for me. And the biggest one, of course, was working with Trudy and making sure this book gets out. The book is called A Matter of Grace, and you can get it at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. If you go to Lulu.com, L-U-L-U Publishing, and buy the book, she makes even more money on it because all the rest take their chunk. Listen, I don't know that's ever going to be a huge bestseller, but let's give it a shot. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, this conversation I've had with Trudy, go out and buy your book and then put up there what you think about it, because such a rare human being in the world today, such a humble, rare, blessed individual is Trudy Groning, and I'm going to let her finish the show. And thanks so much for subscribing. Thanks so much for listening to Life 2.0. Your experiences have given you some really good insights into human behavior.
Yeah.
And I just have to say this as we're sitting here. I'm just observing. Since we started at 11 o'clock, your body language has totally changed.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, you're all lit up and your eyes are bright and you're just... I'm reminded again how important it is to say the words that need to be said, the stuff that hasn't been spoken about, to speak it. Yeah. It's energy. It really is energy. I've watched you today go from 88 to 76 to 64 to 17 to 35. I've watched you. All your ages have come through you. It's really fascinating. Should have had a camera. Really fascinating.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's all encompassing for me. So all of those, the hard times, I'm just telling you what I saw. At hard times, you kind of went in, and then the other things you raise up. And that's the essence of life to me. All the things that have happened to us or through us make us who we are. After all this time on a planet, after all you've seen, all you've been through, all you've heard, all you haven't said, are people still good? Do you think at the core, most people are good?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Despite what the news says,
turn all that off.
But people, when I walk around through here, these good-hearted people.
Yeah, they all are. But yep. So the takeaway is I'm hoping that MSs reading this are encouraged and she can do it, I can do it. I'm not in a chair. I have a leg brace, an ankle brace. I can get rid of that and just go on and on and on. She did it.
When you look back, because here's how I hear, we spent 4 hours doing this. When I look back and watch from where we started in Munich, Germany in 1940, even before that, when you were telling me how Munich was formed and all that, we've gone through history.
Oh, yeah, right.
I know I kind of asked this before. You must look back on your life and go, wow.
Oh, I do.
Just wow.
It amazes me.
Yeah. What a journey, huh? I'm going to ask you to do two things.
What's that?
First thing you do is this forward that you wrote. I want you to read this. into the microphone.
Into the microphone.
Yeah, just like you're reading it out loud with feeling, and you wrote, that's the foreword that you wrote.
When God is leading, there's no mistaking it. It has an engulfing feeling of awareness of heart. It is so invigorating, so exciting, that you intuitively become aware that God is speaking. And that's true. Just as a time before, there was an unmistakable tugging at my heart saying, now is the time. Listen and follow through with writing your book. Many years ago, with the absolute non-skill of a novice, the narrator started visiting, writing an autographical account of her life. Yet, much to her chagrin, she never followed through with it and instead allowed her writings to be put on hold. Now, many years later, there was that great urging, that familiar tug again. It came in many forms: conscience, age, friends, circumstances, all urging to finish writing her book. It is exciting to watch God working miraculously through many snares and toils and illnesses and myriads of hindernesses to fulfill his purpose. A historical account of the life of a young woman stricken with MS. It is a book about World War II and its horrors of persecution of the Jews, Jane's account of her witness as a young girl in the neighborhood of Munich. God was there in her life from the beginning. He never left her and is still there for her, as evidenced by the many instances throughout her life, as the author attempts to illustrate through the character of Jane Raber. She made a vow a long time ago never to be silent again in the face of persecution and the cruelty of silence.
A Matter of Grace is the title. How do you define grace for you?
God's grace.
Yeah, how do you define it?
Every day, 24 hours a day, it's there, and I know it's there. It's in my awareness, my Christian awareness. God is there, and all I do is just rub my eyes and open them and look. If it needs be. I don't do this every day, but if there's a need, look up. That's the heaven God made. So why are you worried? Why are you worried? Look, he's there. I feel it, I see it, I'm conscious of it, and it's such a comforting feeling. There's nothing more powerful than God being around you, even in the worst times, even in MS, even when you think the world is falling out from under you. God is there. He's holding on to you. Don't worry about it. I guess that's it. You don't worry when you know God is there. And that's my feeling.